And so it's always the two lines which are in my work. It's one is the interest in about the notion of sculpture. And the other one is how do I connect these pieces to our world, to our daily life, to our society.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.
Today's guest is the artist, sculptor, painter Erwin Wurm. Welcome, Erwin.
Thank you. Good morning.
Erwin, you span a practice of 50 years. When did you start?
Am I that old? No, maybe 45 okay. years. Yeah.
And
or maybe 40 years. Let's say 40 years.
Okay. So, you wanted to become a painter.
Well, it's true. First, I wanted to become a painter. So for that reason, I tried to get a place in the art school, in the academy, and had to make entrance test.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I wasn't accepted, and they put me in the sculpture class.
So, but how did art come to your life anyhow?
Well, I'm from a family where art basically didn't exist, and literature also not. So it was a nice family. It was a lovely family. But still, my father, art was like... I would say he had the feeling that an artist is already with one leg in the criminal position, because at that time it's even understandable. There were the Viennese Actionists, you know, and then Ernst Fuchs and Lehamauer and Arnulf Reiner. So it was a bit tricky for people who have a normal small bourgeois lifestyle.
And for context, he was a policeman.
He was a policeman.
So he had clients who were artists.
Absolutely, yeah, it's true. And of course, he said you will never can make a living out of it. And even the Staatspreisträger in Austria, it's when some of the older artists get these big prizes for their lifetime. They even cannot make a living out of it. And maybe it was true at that time. Anyway, my mother was a housewife, both loving, both kind. But when I told them I would like to become an artist, so it was really a drama for them. My father was always dreaming that I would become a lawyer or a Staatsanwalt.
Or judge or so.
Mm-hmm. Or judge or so, yeah. So this was another story.
But how did the possibility of becoming an artist anyway occurred in your life? Were there like role models, or was there a family friend? Like how did, first of all, to be in touch with art, but second, to be in touch with the profession of an artist? How?
Yeah. So it began when I got pocket money from my parents, around my 12th year, and then I started to buy paperback books. And one of the first books I remember still, but I still ask myself, why did I buy this book, was from Bertolt Brecht, Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
And because I liked the cover, so I got seducted to buy it, and then I read it, and then I slowly moved into literature.
Mm-hmm.
And this opened us a specific door to, let's say, also philosophy a little bit. And then later on, to arts. And I love the paintings of Picasso, but also of the Surrealists. We had his Surrealists, Ernst Fuchs at that time.
I am. Mm-hmm.
So it was this was a story when I was 14 years old or so.
And Ernst Fuchs was, you said, big. You mentioned him earlier. He had a criminal history.
No. But he looked very, frightening for.
Oh, yeah, like in the hype age.
Yeah. Okay. He had a long beard and his head, and he was always how he behaved. And so this was exceptional. I liked it. The others hated it. And then I had a very, very good teacher in the school, Norbert Nestler.
Mm-hmm.
He was extremely supportive and pulled me more and more into the arts. And then I had also some friends who became artists. They lived actually in the same apartment building as we did. So there were two young people who became artists.
Oh, wow.
This was kind of a pull factor for me. Uh-huh. And yeah.
And this was where? In
Graz.
In Graz. Okay, yeah. So you were already in a bigger city. You were born in a very small place, right?
I was born in Bruck an der Mur, but my mother was only there for giving birth in the hospital. We lived in Kaffenberg.
Uh-huh.
Kaffenberg is close. It's a workers' town. You know, there's this big metal factory, Böhler, and many workers. And so we lived there.
So in the suburb to Graz.
No, this is 50 kilometers away. It's not a suburb anymore.
Oh, okay. So it's not really... So your access was not through museum visits or so?
Not at all.
Only through books?
Books, yes.
Yes. And then you left to...
My father was a policeman, a street policeman first in Kapfenberg, and then he became a detective. And then for that reason, we moved to Graz.
Okay, to the city.
To the city, yeah. Exactly. And there, it was great. It changed perspective totally for me. And
because there were museums and galleries.
And there were not many museums. I mean, at that time, not much happened there.
Yeah.
But there were just a few galleries. But later on, there was the Steirische Herbst.
Exactly, yeah.
In autumn and Wilfried Skreiner and Trigon. And they really brought great art to Graz. So it was always in the fall, it was a hotspot for arts at that time. Mm-hmm. It was really exciting. And then also there was the Forum Stadtpark, which were all the, you know, the famous writers made a collective group. And Peter Handke was there and Coleridge and...
Oh, yeah.
Audrey Bauer.
And also...
Werner Schwab.
Who died in her bed smoking.
Ingeborg Bachmann.
She was in Graz too, right?
Yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. And Werner Schwab, who became later on a very big star. He died also very early with 35. He was a close friend at that time to me.
And then you studied where?
When I told my father I would like to become an artist, you know, the doors were smashing and it was screaming. So it wasn't possible. So he said, first you have to make... First you have to have a profession.
Yeah.
So what was close in Graz, I started to study art history mm-hmm. on the one side. On the other side, teacher, because it was quick. It was 3 years.
Yeah.
And this happened all in Graz.
Yeah.
And my father paid me the first studies, my life for the first studies. Mm-hmm. Second studies, I started to work in a restoration company for stucco, mm-hmm. Sculpture. Mm-hmm. And then I moved first to Salzburg, Mozarteum, because I thought it's a new school, it's exciting, it's things. It was not so great. Anyway, I moved there after half a year. I wanted to go to Vienna. It took me one and a half years to go there. But that when everything happened. So first I was in Salzburg at the Mozarteum, and then I moved to the University for Applied Arts and the Academy for Fine Arts.
Okay, parallel both.
Yeah.
And then you wanted to do painting, but then
exactly.
The sculpture class.
Exactly.
Yeah. But then your early work was very sort of conceptual. You worked with the dust in rooms.
No, it started like this, Johan. First, when I moved there, it was the late 70s, beginning of the 80s, and there all of a sudden the new painting popped up. Mm-hmm. You know, the Mülheimer Freiheit and all these people.
Yeah.
And Fetting, the Berlin group.
Also. Was it in Austria as well?
In Austria, there were Schmalix and Anzinger and Moskva.
Oh, yeah, true.
Mm-hmm. Some of those guys. And I started to make funky sculptures because I had no money at that time at all, so I started to work with... thrift materials or other people threw away. I had a studio. There was a wood workshop close, so I could use the waste wood what they didn't use anymore. And then I was nailing figures together.
Yeah.
Because I found myself in the situation, you know, 70s. There was pop art, minimal art, conceptual art, land art. And I thought, I've read one day, if you want to be successful, you have to overcome your fathers. So I didn't want to put myself in a line in the queue behind the artists which were already working in this direction. So I thought I have to create something new, something strange, exceptional.
Yeah.
So I started to, with wooden boards, I started to nail figures together. So I made figures.
Yeah.
They looked very abstract, but still. And these sculptures I painted then, so color was there.
Yeah.
And it
brought very colorful.
Yeah, exactly. And it brought me a little success, mm-hmm. and I got some galleries all of a sudden, and Wilfried Skreiner showed me and some museums showed me. So it was quick, a little success, great.
Yeah.
But after some years, I've realized that is not really what I want.
Yeah.
I want to do something else. And then I stopped this and tried to find this zero point of the sculpture where I could really start from a new beginning. And these were the dust sculptures.
Okay. And
but, you know, at that time when I changed my style, I lost everybody. I mean, the gallery thought what's going on here, and the critics were writing bad, and the colleagues were in.
And they thought now you went total crazy.
Yeah. This was kind of a tough time.
Yeah.
It took me several years.
Yeah.
But I must say at that time, I have to say it now loud. Galerie Grinzinger, Ursula Grinzinger helped me a lot at that time because she paid me every month 30,000 shilling. At that time, it was quite nice.
Uh-huh,
uh-huh. For 2 years.
Interesting, the old school model.
That I could develop something new. And mm-hmm. this was fantastic. So she really trusted.
But I mean, interesting is also looking back now, it totally makes sense, your evolution,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's interesting, only post looking back, it's
exactly.
understandable how you moved from these figures to the three-dimensional, that
exactly.
you started to work with the second skin, right? With a with closing. I think we have one sculpture in the show right now, which derived from that practice.
Absolutely.
Where you worked with found clothing.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting to see this, how fresh it is.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
The colors, if you wouldn't, you would think it's from today.
Yeah, yeah, I was amazed myself. I actually forgot about it. I had it in the studio somewhere in the storage. And just some months ago, I realized, oh my God, this piece is still there. And yeah, it fits it in a way.
Yeah, so, yeah, because it is just like this sort of bowl or abstract figure stitched together of clothing, and then the legs are looking out on the
metal piles and sticks and so.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I just want to explain what was important for me, that I tried to find the zero point for sculpture. So I started to make a research. What is a sculpture? What does it mean to make a sculpture? Is there any connection possible to society issues? And so it's always the two lines which are in my work. It's one is the interest in about the notion of sculpture. And the other one is how do I connect these pieces to our world, to our daily life, to our society?
Yeah.
And this went on and on. So as I said yesterday, I've realized when you look at the old fantastic sculptures from the Roman or the Greek, they were showing massive bodies, horses, horse riders or athletes or grand women, massive forms. But they were only defined by a very, very thin layer of bronze. So it was a skin. And the volume was empty, and there was no mass. It was just a scenery or an idea about the mass. And this I found interesting. So the skin basically defined sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
And what if I go then if I use clothes? Because this also is in a way a double skin, a second skin of us. And why can I not work with this? And this is where everything started.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this led you into this 1 minute sculptures because you wanted to include the viewer and make them part of it, or how did that evolve?
Actually, it was very connected to my research on notion about sculpture. What is a sculpture? I thought, you know, I had these ideas or questions. When we stand straight in a room, it's an action, but can it also be a sculpture? Or what do I have to do to make an action to transfer this into a sculpture? Do I have to slow it down? Do I have to squeeze it in time or suppress it in time? Or what do we have to do? So I made many exercises and I made many videos about this. So actually there's one man standing still. It's called Still, the video, with a salad bowl on his head, only that you don't see his eye moving because we cannot keep our eyes quiet only when we close them. So and then I was filming this guy. It was a friend of mine. I filmed him for a minute and then I edited it for up to an hour. So when you look at the piece, you see this guy standing quiet. But as our brain is not constructed to see quietness, but movement, we see him moving a little bit, the hand, but he's not moving. So this was a very interesting point for me. It was a sculpture and an action at the same time. But where did it start and where did it end?
Maybe also to explain to the listeners. So the 1 minute sculptures is a series in your work where you give instructions and also sometimes props where people participate, they step on a pedestal or they lean against the wall or they take a chair and then they become a sculpture for 1 minute and they have to practice. And that was very early 90s you did that, no?
Yeah, yeah. So it's when I made this, as I told you, all these videos with trying also with the sweaters, I put my sweaters on and over and my friend and we made short living sculptures. This was a part of it. But then, sorry that I don't answer right now to this question. And then the second part was I created pieces which existed only for a very short period of time. I made these sweater pieces where I had instructions how you would hang the sweaters with two nails on the wall. And then they would like the Pissoir of Duchamp or an Oldenburg or something else. So it was a reminiscence also to my great colleagues. And after the show, you could take the sweaters down and wear them again. So the art piece exists only for a short period of time.
Ah, yeah, interesting. So it's a sweater. It becomes a work of art, but once you disassemble it,
you can wear it as a sweater.
Goes back to normal reality.
Exactly. And to make this clear, I had a show in an American gallerist, Jack Henley, invited me to make a show in San Francisco. He had no money to invite me. I had no money to fly over. So I made these instruction drawings how to fold the sweater. I sent him the instruction drawings. He had to buy the sweaters, put them on the nail, and then when he sold the pieces, and he did. He gave the people a normal folded sweater. It looked like when you buy one from the shop. Mm-hmm. Then they got the instructions and two nails, and they had to hang the sweaters themselves in the house. So I had all these components with which I was working later very intensively in these early works. The short living and the instructions and the part that the public has to do something.
Interesting. Sometimes the missing resources create great work. You know that polka, these flower patterns in polka's work.
Yeah.
When they were studying at the Düsseldorf Academy, they were so broke that Richter did that too, and Kuttner and Luke, who became then the dealer Conrad Fischer, they took from the new drawing room the curtains and paint, and because they had no money for canvases, so they took secretly or sort of stole the curtains from the drawing room and put it on a stretcher and painted on.
Fantastic.
And then he thought, oh, this flower, this element, this pattern comes through. Became an integral part of his practice because of that.
Things are happening like this. Yeah. That's a great example.
Yeah. And tell me, but how interesting is to these works exist very much in the moment. But
yeah,
important, I think, is also when you create art, you want to create something which stays.
Absolutely.
No? So how was it then from you to, because the sculptures, the bronze sculpture, for example, this great one in the pink, that evolved from a one-minute sculpture, right?
Yeah. They all do, actually.
Yeah.
They all do.
And how easy was it for you to find that momentum of translation into physical sculpture?
Well, I know exactly when the one-minute sculptures are very ephemeral. So they appear for 1 minute, was just a synonym for short, for 10 seconds or for 2 minutes, and then they're over. And then that's it. Then they're out of the world of the arts. They're just in the memory. So I had to find a way to prolong them, to make them existing longer. So I invented the instruction drawings and the possibility that the galleries and museums could reinvent them like a partitura in a theater or in a music piece. And this helped me a lot. And then the second thing was I made snapshots of the pieces, mm-hmm, with my camera, cheap photograph, click,
mm-hmm,
and to make them existent in a way. And then we started to sell these snapshots, the photographs.
Like Warhol type, almost like Polaroid.
It was really cheap prints and everything was cheap.
Yeah.
So cheap that some collectors said, no, the photos are so bad, we don't buy them, but we buy the drawings.
Yeah.
But then later on, people thought it's so great, they are so shabby and so not perfect and everything, and they liked them. But the problem became then, I made many photos, and I made many photos inside. The first photo series I did was, I think, 1997, in the Bremer Kunstverein.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a director, Horst Kriese. He was a nice guy. He invited me to make a show, and I took the chance to create the one-minute sculptures for the first time in an exhibition, because before they were always slowly growing in my mind, in my head. But then for some reasons, I never realized them. Whatever. So I came to Bremen. I drove there 10 days in advance, and I could use all the materials I found there. They had a little artist apartment, and then I could also ask the people who worked there to be my models.
Mm-hmm.
And then I created the first one-minute sculptures, and then I pictured them, I photographed them. I tried everything out myself.
Mm-hmm.
I filmed myself with a video camera. There was a lot of failing in it. This is always an important part too.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this created the first numbers of the one-minute sculptures, and we made a series of photographs. So I did not show the actual performance, but I showed the photographs.
Mm-hmm. And then did it work like this? You saw the photo and said, oh, the sculpture is already there? It's like a photo of a sculpture?
Yeah.
And then you made a mold of it and casted it?
Now, this came later, because first I thought, I've learned, that's strange, that's a confession actually I have to make. Whenever I was working on a special idea and in a specific method, let's say when I was working with video or when I was working photographer, it was very hard to think in another way, mm-hmm, except photography or video. And this I had to learn, to pull myself always out of this stream. When you work in a stream, it's like it sucks you in and it's speed up and you go in more and more deeper. But I had no time and I had no head for the other things.
Exactly. This is what the moment I'm interested in is like, when were you, because it's, again, it seems so obvious, But I think in the process, it's not. When did you understand, oh, I can actually transfer it into a physical bronze or aluminium sculpture?
Yeah, yeah.
How did that moment come?
This happened. This came actually, as I also knew, one idea for an artwork or for an artist's life is not enough. I was always developing parallel ideas and new ways because I was always looking for new ways of expressing myself. So I started to make these real 3D sculptures parallel. Fat Car was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And then other pieces with the clothes also. The clothes I was using also in the 80s, also yeah. Before the time of the one-minute sculptures. I made these...
These paintings, these like oversized pullover which turn into paintings.
Yes, and also I made these box people.
Yeah.
You know, I used pedestals and I was dressing them with a coat or with a jacket or trousers.
Which were like strangely dancing almost.
Yeah, exactly. Some were very stiff also. So this was already there, and then I forgot about it, but then I came back to it later. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's always it was moving in circles, but at the moment it looked, in time it looked chaotic, but when you look back it was all very straight, and it was all in a way an interesting development of one idea to the next, and they all are connected.
Because the physical realization of the one-minute sculpture, so to speak, that's relatively... new, no? That's like...
No, 1996 or 5, Hans-Ulrich Obrist invited me to a show which was called Do It.
Exactly, yeah, he's still doing that, I think.
Yeah. There I had the first piece where there was a sweater on the platform or a box with a cover on the platform, and I made instruction drawings, and people were invited to go there and realize the piece. And there was a Polaroid camera where we started to make pictures, so the person could be pictured by a guy or a person standing close. And they could pin then the photograph on the wall, or I would sign them for $100, and they could take an original with them home, which they made after my instruction, and I signed it as an artwork of mine.
No, what I mean is the physical transformation into a sculpture. A lot of the work we have in the show now, they evolved like the pink sweater. You know, there's this. You did these sweaters where people put them on become a one-minute sculpture, and out of the action of the visitor, you created sculptures.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, also I would say that the surreal, sort of grotesque bags with legs,
absolutely,
also come from that because you had props. And I'm interested in when. Sort of you literally casted it in bronze.
Yeah, I can tell you.
The moments casted in bronze.
I can tell you, but I told you that I made first all these videos. I remember the work of 59 positions where I was putting myself into sweaters.
Yeah.
And a friend in unusual situations.
Yes.
Positions.
Yeah.
And we filmed them for 80 seconds each. I wanted to show that there's a person in it. Also, you didn't see the person.
Yeah.
So I wanted to see this moment that is that's a performance. So I filmed this. But when I saw the pictures of the film still, I said, wow, this could also be photographs. And then later on, I thought, wow, this could also be sculptures.
Okay, so it was a visual. You saw the photo, and then you said, okay, that's actually a sculpture.
Yeah.
Okay,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. And also in the show, coming back to your original plan, are paintings. On the first glance, they seem abstract, but they are words. A lot of them have to do with sculpting. Shine,
metal.
How did that come about?
As I told you before, while I made these wooden sculptures in the early 80s, I painted the sculptures because I've realized I can use color as a sculpting instrument, so I can change the sculpture perception with paint.
Yeah.
I can make it, I break it up or deeper or far or whatever.
Yeah.
And then what I did also with paint, and this relates very much to the many layers of sweaters, what you wear above each other, and it becomes a sculpture, and also to Fat Car, I was making dumplings with oil paint. So I made basically what your grandmother, what your mother did. I made dumplings just with oil paint, and I was painting them over and over above it, and they were growing. They were balls like 15 centimeters, some were 20 centimeters big, only existing of oil paint.
Mm-hmm.
So it was both a sculpture and a painting.
Were they connected to the dust? Both
kind of. It was the same time.
Yeah, accumulation of material somehow.
Yeah, accumulation of paint.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make
paint.
Yeah, yeah. So I wanted to make paint paintings and sculptures at the same time. I still have them. I never show them. Sometimes in the past I show them.
And was this the time where you developed your sort of unique color palette?
Yeah.
Like
I don't know why.
You have this baby blue, the pink.
It's like a kid's room in a way. I don't know why.
Yeah, but how, I think it's interesting because it so became such a signature. But that, does this happen planned or subconsciously?
No. Subconsciously. I'm attracted by these colors. And what but afterwards, when I think about it, when I see, for example, now this piece downstairs, it's called pink. It's a dress and it's sweater above each other, cast in aluminium. But through the color pink, I gave them the flash color.
Mm-hmm.
So I bring the pink. The pink is now a synonym for flash to me.
Yeah.
So I transfer the clothes again into flash.
Okay, because skin, yeah.
Yeah.
But back to the painting. So when did you start to do these?
Oh, these paintings. So I didn't allow myself to paint for many, many, many years. But as my wife is doing now, collecting all the early works and everything, she makes a catalogue raisonné. Actually, a catalogue raisonné, it comes out in 3 or 4 years with a great publisher. So it's really fantastic. And she found, because I was always making sketches in little books all my life, and all the ideas are in there. And she found many pages from very early on with the same letters and the same way of writing as I do in the paintings now. So I started this in the early 80s by writing all these names on it. And
fat letters, so to speak.
Yeah, they're kind of...
Blown-up letters.
They're kind of three-dimensional, squeezed into two-dimensionality letters.
Yeah.
And this I did in the early 80s already. But uh-huh. I never made them big. And then later on, I stitched some of those.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember.
I think so. Now, yes. But there were only one letter or something. Right?
No, it was one. Sometimes
full words?
It was full words.
Yeah.
It was Mutter. It was also my the same system. And then some years ago, we moved in the summers to Hydra. It's an island in Greece, and I got bored there when you spent 2 months.
Like a Sunday painter.
Yeah. I went down there as a hobby shop for painters, so I bought these little frames and canvases and hobby oil paint, and I started to paint these words. And it pulled me in all of a sudden. First, I wanted to, make some, just not to get bored, but then it really pulled me strongly into it. So
there you go. And now you even pushed it further, and they become more... gesticular and more...
Yes, yeah. Because what's also interesting, as I told you at the beginning, when you are dealing with one issue, with one work, system and method, you have to develop it. I'm a personality where I have to develop, otherwise I get bored.
Mm-hmm.
The same I did with photography, but the problem with photography was when I started to make these snapshots, these very cheap, not well done and well thought photographs. But when you do this and it became successful and galleries asked me to do more and curators asked me to do more. But then I've realized all of a sudden the history of photography is knocking. It was knocking at my door. Because, of course, I'm a person who looks very precise and see what's happening around. And, of course, I knew all the photography scene. Mm-hmm. But then all of a sudden this history, what you have in your head, wants to get in. And then... it becomes another perception. It became another issue.
Yeah, because this is not what it was about for you, right?
Exactly.
You were only about to document it, the sculpture somehow.
And there were still sculptures for me, also the photographs. Yeah. So then
I needed to somehow find a way to conservate them and grasp the moment and keep it. But it's interesting.
But this was the reason that I stopped photography.
Yeah, but it's also, I think it makes sense because that's so interesting about the sculpture we talked earlier on with the fabric. You can't really put it in time. You know, it's so fresh, it could be yesterday.
I even don't know myself whether this is 20 years or 15 years, I don't know.
But the sculpture, you can see there from the 90s.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Because it's funny that these sculpture, that photography ages on a different level than
absolutely
than sculpture does. No, you can look at the big coat sculpture you did now.
Yeah.
And it could be 100 years ago.
Absolutely.
Or it could exist in 100 years from now. And
to answer your question, because you asked me about the development of the of my paintings, it's the same thing. I start with some idea, with some specifications, how I would like to define it and to use it for my method. But then it starts to change itself, because again, all of a sudden, the history of painting is knocking at the door. So it's an interesting thing. So it pulls me to develop it. to develop myself and to go on myself and to, yeah, to grow somewhere else. And
yeah, but I think that for, with the paintings, that's totally fine with the history of painting because, I mean, they have a certain 70s, maybe from design approach, but then they stand in the history of text painting.
Yeah.
I think they're clearly, because of that of the letter volume, they have that sculptural presence, you know, like a sign or so.
Yeah.
But I think with the photography, because you were not driven by the media photography, you just needed a tool to capture something. But with the painting, I think they're different because they come more out of your own, you know, I'm also always so interested in why people came to art, because it's apparently like an inner force which just needs to come out.
Absolutely.
And you do it if a gallery asks you, a museum, in the end, it doesn't really matter. It helps, maybe.
It helps.
Yeah, but you do it anyway.
Yeah, yeah, you know. It's true.
And do it. You're there in Hydra and start painting.
Exactly.
If someone would have asked you to do a painting show, you would have said, like, are you out of your mind? You
know? Exactly.
Like, why? Do the sculptures not go?
And actually, I call these paintings flat sculptures.
Yeah, yeah. And there's another complete new series, which I think is also, from its craft perspective, spectacular made, which are chairs covered in, again, that's also something you did prior with real fabric, so to speak. But here, and it's unbelievably well executed, the way the fabric and jersey and so on, different fabrics, are casted. Yeah, how did that come together?
Well, you know, by dressing people, I started to think about dressing objects, like furniture or tables or so on. I did it also with tables. And then I've realized, especially with chairs, it's a beautiful result because they hide the chair. You still get a memory of the chair. When I casted them in aluminium, they're empty inside, so you can look into a void, but you still see the surface. And then they have this very quality of strick, of, how do you call it, of cloth. So and then they can transport what's so important for me, ideas. And so I love them. But now we're doing a big show in Fosun, in China, Fosun Foundation,
yeah.
Fosun Foundation. And because of the issues of transporting everything, so I decided to use real chairs there and real clothes and real sweaters for this show. So I will do similar pieces, but with real sweaters and with real chairs.
And what role plays the sweaters you use and the chairs underneath? They're like designed, they're mixed, right? They're like the cheap white chair, the famous one, I forgot the name now.
Yeah, sometimes Eames or whatever, sometimes you can recognize them. It's the same with people. When I started to make the 59 positions many years ago, people were hiding in it. It was never about the personality. It was about the entity of a human being. So you saw that there is a human being, and you never saw that there's a specific person under it. So you could hide personality. You could hide the subject. It's a little bit the same with the chairs. Also, it's recognizable that it's a chair. And it's the game of hide and seek, hiding and not hiding and showing, and then the surface and all this.
But
I cannot explain it. I just love it.
Yeah, but also materialized ideas. Like the other work you present are these, is this mind bubble?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like idea, thoughts on legs.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It comes from the comic strip.
Yeah, no, but it's also you have a thought, and then get legs and walks on.
Absolutely, right? Absolutely. And these chairs I call neuroses.
Mm-hmm. Neuroses?
In a way, as a reminiscent sense to my friend Franz West.
Yeah.
Also, the pieces don't have much to do with it. But it's an Austrian tradition, you know. We, let's say the Austrian invented Sigmund Freud because Austria is such a specific country.
And Jung was Austrian too.
And right? Jung was Austrian too, yes.
Is there anything you haven't done which you still think you need to? You did sculpture, you did video, painting, performance, NFT, or I mean, it's only the carrying media, it's a digital work.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm very, very excited to go on, and I'm still very young, so I hope I have still many years in front of me to develop more things.
Oh, the book, maybe last two, there's a great book coming out by Rainer Metzger.
Yeah. He called me and said, he asked me if I would be interested if he would write a biography about me. It's a bit scary. I just thought first, and But then I said, why not? And then I got warned about him, and then he got warned about me. So, but the, at the end, it was a fantastic collaboration, and he wrote this book, I Had Nothing to Change.
So that was just super quickly went through. There you can, the listeners can read into detail.
Yeah, and it's done with great photographs and a great print. I'm really happy with this book.
Great.
Also, it's a bit embarrassing because it's about myself.
Yeah, but it's, I think it's, we published a Grey children's book.
Yes,
designed by Elise, yeah, where she did the drawings. And
this is lovely. Yeah. I really like it because it addresses so much questions from an interesting perspective.
Yeah, and it takes kids on the journey, how a kid developed to a sculptor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And tell me, because you mentioned the catalogue raisonné, how is that for you? I mean, that's also like a psychoanalysis process, no?
It is, but as we are starting to do a foundation, because, you know, I'm now kind of of a certain age, and then you start thinking, oh my God, I have so many pieces and there's so much things there. And my son is in our in the studio, he's the head of the studio, and my wife is working there since many years. And they're also excellent. So what is going on if I departure tomorrow? Just to protect the work and to secure the work in a specific way and to relate it to others. So my wife started to collect early works, and it was surprising for me because I forgot them, especially the big ones I all remember, but the little sketches and the little sketchbooks, they're full of my ideas, and my whole career is in these sketchbooks.
And how is it for you to look at these early things?
At the beginning, I thought it's not important at all, and I'm not interested, and I don't care about this. But in the meantime, it's so fantastic because it's such a a tool of ideas of my work, and everything is in these little books.
Yeah.
What I developed later, that's so fantastic.
But you feel comfortable going through your earlier things, and
because no, I don't do it. My wife does it.
Ah, okay, you're not so people. Okay,
no,
a lot of artists are very redundant. They don't want to retrospectives.
I'm only interested.
Against catalogue raisonné.
I'm only interested in my new work, what I'm doing now, and towards the future. But as Elise is so fantastic in these things, so I see it from time to time, and I'm now, in the meantime, I'm fascinated what she did.
Super, very much looking forward to it. Thank you so much, Erwin.
Thank you.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.